Chapter 19. Farewell Address. Farewell and stand fast. William Shakespeare. Henry IV, Part 1. Books form an essential part of the history of the U.S. presidency. In the 19th century, the campaign biography emerged as a vital method of promoting presidential candidates. These idealized biographies purportedly showed the American people the manner of man they were electing president. Books authored by presidential candidates have occasionally aided their election as well. Think of such bestsellers as John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage or Barack Obama's Audacity of Hope. Before either campaign biography or the candidate book emerged to promote the policies and personalities of those running for president, American readers sought whatever books they could to learn more about whom they were electing. Around the time of Thomas Jefferson's election to the presidency, for example, contemporary publishers issued new editions of Notes on the State of Virginia. Jefferson had written this book nearly two decades before his election to the presidency, but many Americans read it to learn more about the man who would be president. Books played a part in Washington's presidency as well. In 1796, he could have run for a third term as president. The 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, which limited a president to two terms, would not be ratified until 1951. Had he wanted to run for a third term, Washington could have found few better promotional tools than John Kerry's edition of Official Letters. But he had no intention of running. To inform voters of his decision not to run for a third term, Washington decided to publish an address in the newspapers, which would also appear in book form. This work, now known as his Farewell Address, could be characterized as an anti-campaign book. In no uncertain terms, President Washington let the American people know he would not seek election to a third term. Washington had considered retirement in 1792, the previous election year, but he realized the nation still needed his leadership. Before making his decision to stay for a second term, he asked James Madison to draft a farewell address for him. He liked what Madison had written so much that he held on to the address, thinking he might have the chance to use it in the future. 4 years later, Washington realized that Madison's text now required considerable revision, so he approached Alexander Hamilton for help. Though Hamilton had stepped down as Secretary of the Treasury, he remained the president's most trusted advisor. Washington sent Hamilton a copy of the address Madison had drafted, suggesting two possible courses of action. Hamilton could revise and update Madison's text, or he could draft a new address from scratch. Hamilton preferred the second course, but decided it might be best to prepare the two versions Washington requested, and let him choose which he preferred. By no means did Washington give Hamilton free rein to write whatever he wished. He provided him with a set of guidelines that not only stipulated the contents of the address, but also suggested the tone and diction. "My wish is that the whole may appear in a plain style, and be handed to the public in an honest, unaffected, simple garb." With his emphasis on a plain style, Washington echoes words vital to American literature since early colonial days. In A Description of New England, Captain John Smith had asked his readers for pardon, "if I chance to be too plain or tedious in relating my knowledge for plain men's satisfaction." Similarly, William Bradford emphasizes in Of Plymouth Plantation that he had written his history in a plain style, with singular regard unto the simple truth in all things. Having exerted such a powerful impact on the final version of the farewell address, Washington has sometimes been credited with its authorship. Washington conceived the work. Hamilton took the responsibility for putting the words on the page. Hamilton did not include everything the president wanted him to include. Washington's long list of suggestions contained some that seemed petty and spiteful to Hamilton. Understanding that the very first farewell address by a U.S. president would be a work of lasting historical importance, he purged it of such pettiness. Washington began planning his new farewell address in May 1796. He hoped to present it to the public in time to assure his name would not appear among the candidates for the next presidential election. Hamilton agreed to finish writing the address in a matter of months. While spending part of the summer at Mount Vernon, Washington eagerly awaited the arrival of Hamilton's draft. In early August, he received two versions from his trusted advisor, the revised and expanded Madison text and Hamilton's newly written address. Washington quickly saw the superiority of Hamilton's version and chose it over the revised Madison text. He did not accept Hamilton's version as it stood. Though chock full of good stuff, it was much too long. It would not work without significant cutting. Washington explained to Hamilton, "All the columns of a large gazette would scarcely, I conceive, contain the present draft." Washington did not mention a large gazette solely as a means of illustrating the length of Hamilton's draft. Rather, he intended to publish the work as a newspaper article. Though it is usually called an address, Washington would not present the work orally. Wanting to direct his remarks to the general public, not their elected representatives in Congress, Washington designed the address, as he told Hamilton, "for the yeomanry of this country." The printed word, he decided, would provide the best way to say goodbye to the American people. Hamilton trimmed the text to make it fit a single newspaper issue and sent the revised version to Washington. On Friday, September 16th, Washington dispatched Tobias Lear to pay a visit to printer and newspaper editor David Claypool. Once Lear said that the president wished to see him, Claypool left his print shop for the executive mansion, where he found the president alone. Washington let him know he was leaving office at the end of his second term and wished to publish a farewell address to the American people in his newspaper, Claypool's American Daily Advertiser. Flattered that Washington had chosen his paper to announce the resignation, Claypool assumed the president's choice was a sign that he appreciated the way he conducted his paper. Agreeing with Claypool's assumption, Washington nodded and then asked how soon he could publish the address. Once the printer told the president that he could publish it whenever he wanted, they agreed to issue it on Monday, September 19th. Lear brought the manuscript of the farewell address to Claypool's print shop Saturday morning. Claypool set the manuscript in type and struck some proof sheets, which he brought to Washington, who corrected the proofs himself. Once he was finished with the manuscript, Claypool came to the executive mansion to return it. As he spoke with the president, he got up the gumption to ask him a favor. Could he keep the manuscript? Washington was happy to let him have it. Few printers have been so well rewarded for their work. After it appeared in Claypool's American Daily Advertiser that Monday, Washington's farewell address was quickly reprinted in newspapers throughout the nation in the coming days and weeks. In Philadelphia, some newspapers reprinted the address the same day it appeared in Claypool's. Andrew Brown, for example, included it in the September 19th issue of the Philadelphia Gazette. Jacob Hiltzheimer, whose diary provides a vital record of the period of Washington's presidency, read the farewell address in the Philadelphia Gazette and recorded his impressions. "The advice he gives to the nation, I hope, will be remembered by all good citizens to the end of time." William V. Murray, who read Washington's address in a Maryland paper later that week, said about it, "The effect of his piece has been immense. The men who can think at all feel and acknowledge the force of his advice and maxims." Besides reprinting the address in their newspapers, printers from Lancaster, Pennsylvania to Lansingburg, New York, also issued it in pamphlet form. Publishers of small format newspapers often could not fit the entire address within the columns of a single paper. Some subdivided it into two installments, but many hesitated to destroy the work's strength and power by splitting it. Instead, they issued it in pamphlet form. When Benjamin Bates reprinted it in the Aurora, he avoided editorializing, but he did split the address into two parts, a reflection of his disrespect for Washington. Other publishers reprinted it in their newspapers first and then released the address as a pamphlet. The printers faced a tricky problem as they attempted to issue the work separately. Neither Washington nor Hamilton had titled it Farewell Address. That title would not be coined until later. In Claypool's, the address appeared under the heading To the People of the United States. But this heading would not do as the title of a pamphlet. Printers were left to their own devices to devise titles for the work. Samuel Cushing, a printer in Amherst, New Hampshire, took the straightforward approach. Having published the address as The President's Resignation in the Village Messenger, he subsequently issued a pamphlet edition titled The President's Address to the People of the United States on His Declining Another Election. New York printer James Orem titled his edition Resignation of His Excellency George Washington, but used a catchier phrase from the address as the pamphlet's running head, The Disinterested Warnings of a Parting Friend. In Newburyport, Massachusetts, William Barrett published the work under the title President Washington's Resignation and Address to the Citizens of the United States. Boston printer John Russell titled his edition The Legacy of the Father of His Country. This title emphasized the didactic nature of Washington's text. Besides announcing his resignation, the address provided advice for the nation and its people. As Barrett said in an advertisement for his edition, this valuable legacy of good advice, which he has bequeathed on his departure from public life, the result of long experience and expressed in the language of firmness and paternal affection, should, as we have no doubt it will, be engraven deeply on the minds of his fellow citizens and transmitted with their sanction and approbation to their posterity. Many printers took pains to make their pamphlet editions examples of fine bookmanship. When he announced the publication of The Legacy of the Father of His Country, John Russell said it would be elegantly printed with a new type on vellum paper. According to Russell's advertising copy, the pamphlet would be a pretty specimen of American arts, the type, paper, ink, and workmanship being wholly American, and which must, if possible, enhance its value in the esteem of the friends to our country's progress in the arts. As part of the legacy of the Father of His Country, Russell included a preface justifying the reprint and characterizing the work. Since it had already appeared in newspapers across the nation, a pamphlet edition might not seem necessary, but, Russell assured his readers, it was. Whoever contemplates for a moment the pure morality and political principles, the ardent patriotism and useful information contained in all the addresses of our endeared general in war and president in peace, and considers that this may be his valedictory, will readily see the propriety of its taking a form less perishable than the pages of a gazette. Handsomely printed pamphlet editions, Russell explained, were more likely to preserve Washington's words from the ruin of time. Russell almost makes the purchase of the pamphlet a matter of civic duty. The more copies that are preserved, the more widely Washington's message will be disseminated and the more likely it will be preserved for future generations. Though all these pamphlet reprints seem designed to capitalize on Washington's farewell address, their printers were not solely motivated by greed. Gauging by the comments in their prefaces and advertisements, they were also motivated by altruism. The printers wanted to produce handsome keepsakes to make sure Washington's farewell words would endure. The hyperbolic language they used to describe the work reinforces its lasting qualities. Speaking about Russell's edition, one extravagant reader said, "It is a valuable fund of truly Republican and patriotic advice and ought to be bound with the richest binding, covered with diamonds inlaid in gold, and grace the shelf of every library." An advertisement for another Boston edition said it was worthy a page of marble and a cover of gold. Washington's farewell address appeared in other forms as well. Some printers issued it as a broadside suitable for framing. An advertisement in the Albany Gazette announced, "The President's Address in Gilt Frames. Gentlemen who wish to be supplied with it in this form are requested to send their names in the course of this week to Webster's Bookstore." Framed and hanging on the wall, Washington's address could be read time and again. And when it was not being read, its presence in the home still served as an inspiration. Hanging on a wall inside the home, the farewell address took on the qualities of a talisman. In both pamphlet and broadside form, Washington's farewell address was sold on city streets throughout the nation. While walking down Broadway in New York with his wife one day, Alexander Hamilton encountered an old soldier hawking copies of the address. Hamilton took pity on the tattered man and bought a copy, whereupon he said to his wife, "That man does not know he has asked me to purchase my own work." Hamilton's old soldier recognized a hot commodity when he saw it. In short, Washington's farewell address was the bestseller of 1796. Contemporary almanacs also reprinted Washington's address. Since it originally appeared in September, that is, shortly before the almanacs for the following year were printed, some almanac makers found it appropriate to include its text in their works. That way, people could read and reread the address throughout the following year. For example, Hugh Gain included Washington's farewell address in his almanac, Gain's New York Pocket Almanac for the year 1797. With a copy of Gain's almanac tucked inside a coat pocket, New Yorkers could reread Washington's address whenever they had a little spare time on their hands. Whereas Russell argued that pamphlets were more lasting than newspapers, some of his contemporaries worried that newspapers, pamphlets, broadsides, and almanacs were all too ephemeral to assure the survival of Washington's address. They found yet another way to reprint it in a more lasting form. On November 5, 1796, the New York State Senate resolved that the said address be inserted in the journal of this Senate as a perpetual testimony of our respect for the man and our approbation of his sentiments. The New York Assembly followed suit, resolving that the patriot address of George Washington, President of the United States, to the people of the said states, be entered at length upon the journals of this House as a memorial to future ages of their unabated affection to that illustrious citizen and of the high sense of the eminent and disinterested services which he has rendered his country. Legislators from several other states, Delaware, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, resolved to print Washington's address as part of their proceedings. Aware that printed editions of legislative proceedings had a lasting quality that some other print genres lacked, the legislators from all these states could rest assured that they had preserved Washington's address for future generations by including it in their proceedings. Rhode Island legislators arranged to have Washington's address printed as part of the front matter of the 1798 edition of its state laws, along with the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Washington's farewell address has been called one of the great American documents. Its placement with the Declaration and the Constitution affirms its lofty status as a major national document. Readers obtained copies of the pamphlet not only to read, preserve, and perpetuate Washington's words, but also to possess them. The experience of Allen Melville, Herman's father, provides an example of what the farewell address meant to contemporary readers. Then, a teenage student at Amherst Academy, he obtained a copy of Samuel Cushing's edition, The President's Address to the People. Melville may have purchased this pamphlet, but he could have received it as a gift. All the students at another New Hampshire school, Phillips Exeter Academy, received free copies of the Exeter edition of Washington's farewell address. Allen Melville's acquisition of the Amherst edition is consistent with his personality and taste. Not only did he venerate the heroes of the Revolutionary War, he also read numerous conduct books instructing him on proper behavior. Washington's inspiring words enhanced Allen Melville's veneration for the father of his country and gave him advice regarding how future generations of American citizens should behave. Many contemporary readers of the farewell address characterized it as a conduct book. Senator George Cabot, for one, referred to the work as the President's Advice, and the editor of the New Jersey Journal observed, "This address resembles the fond advice of a dying parent to his beloved children." Allen Melville read the work often enough that he could repeat snippets of it by heart. Though Washington himself did not read the address aloud, it would be read aloud countless times in the coming years. It became a standard text in the American schoolboy's repertoire. At the end of each term, students would typically recite inspiring texts from their classroom readers. Almost as soon as Washington's address appeared in the newspapers, the textbook makers recognized its potential. Before the year was out, in fact, anthologists began including the work in their compilations. In Hudson, New York, the Reverend Bildad Barney included the complete text of Washington's address in An Introduction to the Art of Reading, a textbook he published in late 1796. Washington's farewell address remains an inspiration. Instead of talking down to the American citizens, he addresses them eye to eye. Speaking in the persona of a departing friend, he demonstrates that he knows how they feel and shares their deepest convictions. Acknowledging their passion for political freedom, he says that he hardly needs to say anything. The love of liberty is already deeply ingrained within the American psyche. The U.S. government symbolizes that liberty. Protecting government requires vigilance. National unity is his preeminent theme. People must cherish their national identity, which should take precedence over any local identity. We are Americans first, and New Englanders, New Yorkers, Virginians, or Georgians second. Continuing his argument, Washington stresses how the different parts of the nation are interdependent. The commerce of the North, for example, provides an outlet for the agricultural products of the South. Identifying North and South as two different parts of the nation, Washington reinforces an already well-established distinction. He proceeds to make a more forward-thinking geographical distinction, East and West. Kentucky and Tennessee had become states during his presidency, and Washington saw that the future of the West was the future of the nation. The further development of the East would depend upon the future development of the West, which would provide a valuable vent for the commodities the East imported from abroad or manufactured at home. Washington's address also stresses the power of the U.S. Constitution and the importance of following it. In addition, it emphasizes the value of maintaining peace and harmony with all nations. Americans should guard against foreign influence, sustaining their national identity as an example of people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Washington concludes by reinforcing his identity with his fellow citizens, telling them how much he's been looking forward to living as one of them. "I anticipate with pleasing expectation that retreat, in which I promise myself to realize, without alloy, the sweet enjoyment of partaking, in the midst of my fellow citizens, the benign influence of good laws under a free government, the ever-favorite object of my heart, and the happy reward, as I trust, of our mutual cares, labors, and dangers." On September 19th, the day David Claypool first issued the farewell address in his newspaper, George and Martha Washington left Philadelphia to return to Mount Vernon for a brief visit. Throughout his presidency, they had typically returned home around this time of year. By returning to Mount Vernon that fall, Washington escaped all the questions about his retirement and all the pleas for him to remain president for a third term. After returning to Philadelphia, one day Washington happened to have dinner with Robert and Henrietta Liston, the British minister to the United States, and his wife. The Listons had only just arrived in the United States that May. Though Liston had not looked forward to the appointment beforehand, Washington had proven to be an unexpected delight. Both he and his wife were thoroughly impressed with the American president. Robert Liston wrote home, "I have read much about this great man, but no passage in his history prepared me to see such commanding dignity in person and behavior." They, too, had been hoping Washington would serve a third term. When Henrietta Liston told him about their desire for him to stay in office, Washington smiled and asked if she remembered the story of the Archbishop of Granada in Gil Blas. Fearing the debilitating effects of old age on his intellect, the Archbishop asks Gil Blas, his servant, to let him know when the quality of his sermons begins to deteriorate, assuring him that his frankness would be rewarded. Once the Archbishop suffers a stroke and his mind becomes impaired, his sermons appreciably decline. As gingerly as possible, Gil Blas informs His Eminence that his sermons have deteriorated. Refusing to acknowledge his diminishing intellectual capacity, the Archbishop flies into a rage and dismisses Gil Blas for his insubordination. "I feared," Washington told Henrietta Liston, "that the same might happen to me." Washington need not have worried. The quality of his public speeches had in no way declined during the course of his presidency, as his last speech to Congress demonstrates. On Wednesday, December 7, 1796, President Washington delivered his final speech to Congress. The gallery was jam-packed with spectators, who met Washington's entrance into Congress Hall with awe. Adorned in a black velvet suit with his long sword at his side, Washington made an impressive sight, as he knew he would. While sharing several points of contact with the farewell address, this speech took a somewhat different approach. Whereas his farewell address had offered many general guidelines for governing the nation to assure its survival, his last speech to Congress offered some practical suggestions. In the farewell address, for example, Washington told people to promote institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge. He'd wanted to develop this idea further in the farewell address, to emphasize the importance of establishing a national university, where the youth from all parts of the United States might receive the polish of erudition in the arts, sciences, and belles-lettres. Hamilton recommended that the speech to Congress, rather than the farewell address, would be a better place to express his educational scheme. After some thought, Washington took Hamilton's advice. With his last speech to Congress, the president stressed the importance of establishing both a military academy and a national university. A flourishing state of the arts and sciences, he explained, would contribute to the material prosperity and reputation of the United States. A national university would contribute to the assimilation of the principles, opinions, and manners of our countrymen by the common education of a portion of our youth from every quarter. He continued, "The more homogeneous our citizens can be made in these particulars, the greater will be our prospect of permanent union, and a primary object of such a national institution should be the education of our youth in the science of government." Schools were not the only institutions President Washington recommended in his final speech to Congress. Emphasizing the importance of agriculture to the nation, he urged the establishment of a Board of Agriculture. Boards devoted to other fields of useful knowledge could also be established. Washington explained that the establishment of boards, composed of proper characters, charged with collecting and diffusing information, and enabled by premiums and small pecuniary aids, could encourage and assist a spirit of discovery and improvement. Once he had presented his last speech to Congress, it too was published in pamphlet form. In no way did it achieve a level of status commensurate with his farewell address. Some readers did recognize that the two works complemented one another. The Philadelphia printing duo of Henry Schweitzer and John Ormond, for example, published the address and the speech together under the title Columbia's Legacy. The 1796 election took place shortly after Washington delivered his last speech to Congress. The first contested presidential election in American history, this election pitted the Federalists against the Republicans. Though the American people had enjoyed the message of national unity Washington had conveyed in his farewell address, it did not seem to affect their behavior when it came to party politics. The 1796 election proved to be a heated contest. With 71 electoral votes, John Adams edged out Thomas Jefferson, who received 68 electoral votes. As the government was then organized, the candidate who came in second place in the balloting would serve as vice president. With John Adams's election to the presidency, Washington could relax and enjoy his final few months in office before going home to Mount Vernon. Previously, at the end of both the Revolutionary War and the Constitutional Convention, Washington had stocked up on reading material, buying many new books before returning home. At the end of his presidency, he hardly needed to do so. During his two terms in office, he had accumulated far more books than he had had time to read as president. Some he had purchased himself, others he had subscribed to as a way of encouraging the development of American literature. Many he had received as presentation copies from their authors. He looked forward to reading many of these unread books in his retirement. Some of the books Washington obtained as president indicate that as a part of his future reading, he would return to a literary genre that had been one of his favorites in the past, travel literature. Thomas Forrest, an explorer and navigator who had worked for the East India Company since the 1750s, sent Washington a copy of his Voyage from Calcutta to the Mergui Archipelago, which provided much detail about navigating the Bay of Bengal. Washington received other works about the East Indies. He obtained a copy of Captain Matthew Jenner's Route to India, and, best of all, William Bligh's Narrative of the Mutiny on board His Britannic Majesty's ship Bounty. Though Bligh is best remembered as a captain whose supposed cruelty had led to one of the most famous mutinies in the history of the British Navy, his navigational skill and powers of endurance were extraordinary. After Fletcher Christian and his fellow mutineers left him and his few loyal crew members in an open boat in the middle of the Pacific, Bligh safely navigated the craft to Timor, a distance of some 3,500 miles. In Narrative of the Mutiny, Bligh relates his personal story in vivid detail. Filled with technical details about navigation, the works of Forrest and Jenner lack the excitement of Bligh's narrative, but they do contain a few memorable moments. One contemporary reviewer suggested Captain Janoor provided just the kind of reading material someone might enjoy in retirement. Shortly after he retired, Washington informed a correspondent that he would no longer travel beyond a 20-mile radius of his home. His library would let him travel the world without leaving his home. Janoor's route to India, the reviewer suggested, could afford some amusement to those who are content to travel to India by the fireside. Washington's last few weeks in office seemed like little more than a series of celebrations. February 22nd, of course, was Washington's birthday. Throughout his administration, the local clergymen, first in New York and then in Philadelphia, had made a point of visiting President Washington en masse to wish him a happy birthday. This year he celebrated his 65th birthday, meaning that he was now entering his 66th year. The Reverend Ashbel Green, the Presbyterian minister who served as chaplain to the U.S. Congress, recorded the event for posterity. Green found that on this occasion the president spoke with singular vivacity. "Gentlemen, I feel the weight of years," Washington said to the clergyman. "I take a pair of sixes on my shoulders this day." Though Green recorded the president's words, he didn't get his joke. Reverend Green understood that the pair of sixes referred to Washington's age, but he did not know what the president meant by the word sixes. Washington was referring to six-pounder guns. To a spiritual man like Green, the idea of a man carrying a couple of cannon around on his shoulders was unimaginable, but not to Washington. On Friday, March 3rd, the day before John Adams was inaugurated, Washington hosted his last dinner party as president. It was a gala affair attended by many of the leading citizens in the nation. President-elect Adams and his wife Abigail attended. So did Vice President-elect Jefferson. The cabinet members were there, and so were several foreign ministers and their wives, including Robert and Henrietta Liston. Bishop William White left the fullest account of the occasion. Hilarity prevailed during dinner. Afterward, the dinner guests suddenly grew quiet as Washington, having filled his glass, stood up and lifted it to toast his company. He spoke with a smile on his face. "Ladies and gentlemen," he began, "this is the last time I shall drink your health as a public man. I do it with sincerity and wishing you all possible happiness." Bishop White looked around at the company. Washington's guests were visibly moved by his words. Henrietta Liston had tears running down her cheeks. She was not the only one.